My name is Alana, and you are listening to Give a Damn, a podcast that intentionally and mindfully explores life's common challenges in order to break down the barriers between us and become the best version of yourself. Friends, and welcome back to the Give a Damn podcast. My name is Alana Weinroth. Before we dive into today's episode with former Giving Keys president Brittmore Gilmore, I wanted to just tap in for a second as it's been a really heavy week with everything that has been going on in our country, all the marches and protests, and the fight for a long deserved racial justice and equality. I was going to do an episode just directly talking to you about that, but as Britt and I recorded a couple weeks ago, this episode is very pertinent to what's going on. And I thought that as we are all trying in our different ways to educate ourselves and become better allies and fight for equality and justice, I think if you haven't done any work yet, this is a really great place to start and learn a little bit. Britt is very passionate about prison reform, which, as many of us know, majority of the prison populations are Black, and she's also very passionate about employing individuals experiencing homelessness, and that also has a high population of Black individuals by no fault of their own, because of the way that our country it has set them up for failure. So I just wanted to say that I love you all. Please do your work and your research. I will post resources as well throughout the coming weeks. And I really hope that you enjoyed this interview. Welcome, my friends. Thank you for tuning back into the Give a Damn podcast. I hope you've been enjoying all the wonderful interviews that we've had on the podcast lately. I think now more than ever, it's so important to hear what other people are doing, how they're getting through this quarantine, and just the things that they've overcome in their lives to get to where they are, because we all have our stuff in our lives that we need to overcome. So you are not alone. And I want to make sure that you know that, hence bringing on some more guests and hearing from some people besides me. Today on the podcast, I am going to be talking to my dear, amazing friend, Brittmore Gilmore. Britt, a native of Detroit, is the former president of the Giving Keys, a company that employs people transitioning out of homelessness in Los Angeles to make inspirational jewelry and accessories. After 7 years of testing and iterating an employment program that employed 130 people transitioning out of homelessness, she turned her focus to systems change work and scaling the model to get hundreds more people transitioning out of homelessness back into the workforce across a variety of industries. She did this work as the Homeless Workforce Program Advisor for United Way, helping lead a 100 Jobs in 100 Days challenge in partnership with LA County. Britt consults social entrepreneurs and impact-focused initiatives, and she made the Forbes 30 Under 30 list in 2017. Welcome to the Give a Damn podcast, Britt.
Hello. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for letting me join you.
Oh my God, absolutely. I have the privilege of bringing friends on because I already know the amazingness of you, and I just want the whole world to know that, which they know. But as I was telling you, you and I have these really beautiful conversations because we geek out on this space of serving our communities, of the homeless workforce initiatives. And I think there's a lot of people who don't know a lot about that. So I'm really excited for you to educate people on that today.
Yeah, Definitely. I'm excited to share.
Cool. So, Britt, let's start a little bit from the beginning because, as we all know, we are a symptom of the way that we are raised. And I know that you were raised in a really unique way. So, can you just give everyone a little bit of background about like where you grew up and just the way you were raised and how you are the way you are?
For sure. So, I was originally born in Tennessee. But my family moved to Michigan, just outside of Detroit, when I was 2 years old. So I grew up in the suburbs of Detroit. My dad was actually a pastor, and he and my mom ran a church together for the majority of my childhood, actually for all of my childhood. And I would say that a lot of what my parents were all about in terms of engaging with the community. My dad actually did some really powerful and like inspiring work that really formed who I am around bringing Black churches and white churches together, which isn't something that I like share about often, but I've been reflecting on it more just as there's been like the Ahmaud Arbery tragedy and just some things around race that are a really big part of the mainstream conversation right now. So I've just been reflecting on that. So it's kind of top of mind. But yeah, I grew up in that family. My mom was always very entrepreneurial and doing a million things, like writing a book. She was like a signed performing artist and put out a record and toured. And I would tour with her and be her backup singer. And we had a lot of fun, but now she's doing really cool work around hydroponic urban farming that is focused on providing produce in food deserts in Detroit and making sure that people have access to produce and healthy options. So definitely who my parents are really impacted me and the things that I care about and how I wanted to spend my time and my career. Which really is what led me in a lot of ways to working at the Giving Keys and having a career that was focused on impact. But I think the maybe distinct thing that I learned over time was that it didn't always have to happen through this like ministry channel or nonprofit channel. And not that either of those approaches are bad or different. I just was really interested in this intersection between impact and like for-profit models. So I think that's kind of where I took what my parents had given me and modeled to me, but then moved in this direction that brought it into the business domain. So yeah, I'm really grateful for the experiences that they gave me, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I think that what they modeled for you is the importance of taking care of your community. I did not know that about your dad bringing Black churches and white churches together. I mean, that's incredible. How did that go? Like, what did he create a church just for everybody to join? And is that still around? I'm curious.
So when he was pastoring his church, it was more about creating these regional meetings where they would bring Black churches from like Detroit proper, inner city Detroit, and suburban white churches together. And I remember this one meeting that was happening like in a theater. I can't even remember what city it was in, somewhere surrounding Detroit. And they did this really powerful like symbolic reconciliatory, I don't even know how to describe it. It's really hard to put into words, but it was essentially the acknowledgement of what slavery has done over the long term to impact in a negative way the experience of Black people in America and how that grew into other things, Jim Crow, mass incarceration. And I remember them essentially like my dad and some of the other white pastors apologizing publicly for what had happened and taking this very humble posture and just acknowledging the pain and the scourge of racism. And I was probably 12 or 13 years old at the time. And I will never forget it. Like, everyone in the room was weeping. There was just like such a powerful, humbling atmosphere in the room. And just the acknowledgement of, the pain and the suffering and the commitment to unity, but not in like the trite sort of, we're all together in this, we're all one. It was deeper than that. It was like really seeing the evil and the pain of the past and committing to a different kind of future.
That sounds so powerful, and you actually said it really eloquently, and I'm happy that you shared that given the current state of our country, of our world always, and our country kind of a lot lately. So that's really beautiful to hear that there are people who acknowledge differences. And I think you touched on something so important with that, is that I see that in your work, that in the work, in the field that you and I are in sort of this social services, but particularly working with the homeless community in Los Angeles, it's really important to not try to sympathize, but to just acknowledge that we don't all have the same opportunities and to own your privilege. So let's talk a little bit about Giving Keys. So I know that you were interested in fashion and maybe even went to fashion school, and then were also interested in giving back to your community, and then you like found Giving Keys. So what did that look like for you? What was your role there, and sort of how did that shape into what it was in your life?
Yeah, you're right on. I went to fashion school. When I graduated high school, I knew that I wanted a career where fashion and impact intersected. And kind of went on this path of, I'm going to learn everything I can about the fashion industry and be equipped to either start my own brand or work for another company, but always with impact at the center. And moved to LA in 2009 to go to FITM, the fashion school here, and met Caitlin, the founder of the Giving Keys, a couple years after I graduated. And we really hit it off. Caitlin has grew up in LA and knows a lot of people in the fashion industry, but I've heard her say before, the thing that really connected us or made her feel confident about bringing me into her company was that I was in the fashion business and had worked in retail and worked as a celebrity stylist and had managed a fashion e-commerce business, but I also really cared about the community and I cared about people. And she had started building and baking in this employment model of employing people transitioning out of homelessness to help produce the jewelry and to fulfill the orders. And she knew that she needed somebody to come in that understood how a fashion business operated, but also would really care about the mission and take care of the team and be able to balance both of those things.
Yeah. What did you see, I guess, in your time, and what did you see that worked well at Giving Keys? What can you tell people about employing the homeless or formerly homeless community? What were some of the biggest challenges, but also can you share like a success story that really shaped you?
Yeah. And I think I missed a part of your last question, which was like, what role did I play?
Yeah.
So just to touch on that really quickly, when I first got brought in, the company only had 3 employees. It was really small. So I started as the production manager, and I was helping create the process for how we fulfilled orders and just systematize everything. And then within a couple months, I had said to Caitlin, I'm like, the website could use a redo. Can I replatform it? And so because I had worked in e-commerce previously, I transitioned us from Magento platform to Shopify, and we like doubled daily sales as soon as that site went live, just because the experience was so much easier to navigate. And then a few months after that, we were working with a consultant who was helping us figure out what the org structure should look like. And at that point, I became the managing director. So I was overseeing all the operations. I was running the office, running the team, so Caitlin could really be out selling and building the brand and telling the story and spreading the word. So that was kind of like the beginning. And then 2 years after I became managing director, we changed my title to president, just because like nobody in the fashion business knew what a managing director was. It's not really a common title in that industry. And so, yeah, I was at the company from 2012 till just last November in 2019. So it was like a 7-year beautiful stint. But to your question about what it was like employing people experiencing homelessness and a success story. One of the most powerful moments I can remember from my time in total, like all 7 years combined, was we had a team meeting every Monday morning. And one team meeting several years ago, I invited one of our new hires to share, which was a pretty common thing. One of the things we did in our onboarding was we always let the new hire pick a word and a key that would be like their free gift as they joined the team. Mm-hmm. And we would always invite them, the new hire, to share after they had gotten their key to explain what word they chose and why. And I asked one of our new hires to share and kind of put an additional question on there, which was, how are things going for you here? Like, how's the new job? What's your experience been like so far? And she, important context, when she first showed up, which was like 2 weeks prior to this team meeting happening, she was like hunched shoulders, staring at the floor, wouldn't make eye contact with people, very soft-spoken. You could tell she just was very anxious and didn't necessarily feel comfortable. Then 2 weeks later, when she's sharing in the team meeting, she's standing there with her shoulders back, head up, making eye contact with the people in the room as she's sharing. And she said, I've never before in my entire life ever been told that I was beautiful.
Oh.
And I have heard that 3 times since I've been here in the last 2 weeks. And she's like, the crazy part is that I actually believe you all.
Wow.
I actually believe that I am beautiful and I feel confident and I feel like I can handle what I need to handle and I can take life on. And I haven't felt that way in a very long time.
Wow, Brit.
And that is... there's so many things we can talk about when we're talking about working with the homeless population, like what kinds of jobs are the right fit and how do we move people like through career steps, and we can get really technical about it, which is a lot of what I spend my time doing. But there is this other part of it that is relational, and mm-hmm. it's healing, and it's creating an environment where someone has the space and the ability to transform themselves, and creating an environment that doesn't hold someone's past against them, that sees them with new eyes, that gives them the chance to become who they were meant to be and who they want to be. And that's what we tried really hard to do at Giving Keys. And that's what they're still trying to do at Giving Keys. I mean, it's still operational and still employing people exiting homelessness, but that story to me just really symbolizes the beauty of the work that we got to do every day, or that I got to do every day.
Yeah.
And then there's like all the other side of it that's like, what was our model? How much time did we work with people? that we can get into too, because I think that's helpful for anybody who's considering working with this population or other populations that have barriers to employment. But nothing can top that moment for me, honestly. Like, it was just too good.
Well, and that's so – I love that story because – and for anyone who doesn't know, the reason that we know each other and became friends is because we worked together, because Giving Keys would employ Covenant House youth. And yeah, the one thing that you and I talk about so often, and we just see, we both have seen in our work, is that – and this goes for anybody, though, is that – having the space to feel comfortable and confident when, and especially for these young people or young adults or elderly people who spent their entire lives not feeling like enough. Like, if you spent your whole life, people not telling you that you were enough and that you were valuable, and then to walk into a workspace where people are, you feel valued, you feel appreciated, you feel like you have the space to, you know, address the issues that you're going through, but that it's addressed respectfully. And that's the first time you've ever felt that way in your life. That's life changing. So you guys really are giving people life changing opportunities. And I've gotten the privilege to see that firsthand too. So I think that story, like, again, out of this, like, the technicalities of employing somebody who's homeless or formerly homeless, that though is, I think, one of the biggest components of successfully hiring somebody.
Yeah, I totally agree. And the cool thing about that woman's story is that she, when she came to work with us, she had lost custody of all five of her children. Ugh. She didn't have a stable place to live. And then within 2.5 years, she had gotten her own apartment, had gotten custody of 4 out of 5 of her children back. Now she has custody of all 5.
Wow.
She started her own company and did that for a couple of years and did it well and made really good money doing a cleaning service business. So she's like doing so well. She just had another baby, actually. Wow. Her and I stay in touch. And probably the even cooler part, like, yes, all those successes, amazing. She, like, got herself so far so quickly. But I just talked to her a few weeks ago when I've been doing some COVID relief support work for the homeless population here in LA during quarantine. And it's been pretty demanding. And I was working some really long and hard days. And it's hard to hear the stories of what people experiencing homelessness are experiencing now in this time of COVID, and it can just get heavy sometimes. And so she called me to check in on me, and I picked up, and like, she's like, "How are you doing?" And I started crying, and I'm like, "It's just really sad and it's hard today." And she totally was like my comforter and was able to just, she's like, "It's a Friday night. You need to spend some time with your husband. You need to take care of yourself this weekend. Like, I know it's hard and there's a lot of work to be done." She's like, "But you got to know your limits." Like, she turned into my coach. And I just love that dynamic of, like, we also can see people, I think, experiencing homelessness is like, we're always in the position of helper and they're always in the position of being helped. But there are so many skills and gifts and abilities that people in that position have to give, and if we would just be like in a posture to receive from them, there's like so much to be gotten from folks in that experience too. I'm sure you've experienced that before, but she literally just took care of me emotionally in that moment. It was so great.
I love that. I'll tell you, there's been many times where I've had a bad day at work and a Cub kid is like, "Everything's going to be all right." And that is, I'm like, Bible, everything's going to be all right because he said so. So those resilient humans are more wise than many of us. So, I love that, Britt. That's such a cool story. So for the sake of time, I also just want to go into How did your work at Giving Keys then, how did that shape the model? Like, you created this model, basically, for creating system change work. So you took what you were doing at Giving Keys and were like, I want to kind of bring this everywhere and take the lessons that you learned about what worked well and what didn't. Can you share what those things are? I know I mentioned in your intro that you were working as the Homeless Workforce Program Advisor for United Way, and you still are right now. So what is that model look like? What can people learn about what works well and what doesn't?
So the thing that we at Giving Keys feel really strongly about and baked into our model was that we felt it was critical that our hiring managers and our HR staff were in direct contact with the case managers and the employment specialists that were supporting the folks that were transitioning out of homelessness or being employed on our team. And sometimes yep. in other structures, there can be a pretty big gap, or there may be no connection between a case manager and a hiring manager, or a case manager and HR staff at the company where the client works. And it was really important to us that we designed that relationship and set up those agreements with the case management agencies that we had like a direct line, and that also that the client and the employee like legally allowed us to share information back and forth so that we could really be a team supporting that person's success. Like the case manager plays one role, the employer plays another. Yeah. And it wasn't necessarily that we were like talking every day. But in the early stages, if there were issues with transportation or there were issues with even case management meetings, like that came up a lot, where there would be some sort of like housing coordination meeting or a case management meeting that would happen during the day when the homeless service agency was open, and it could impact their work. And so if we could work together to make sure that that person was tapping into their PTO, in our model and in our business, we were more generous than I think businesses would have to be, but it's great if they can be. We would give comp time to our staff to go to those case management meetings or to go to those housing coordination meetings, just so that they wouldn't. One of the things that we found, and we kind of learned over time, especially early on, was that people were not going to certain meetings that they needed to go to like secure housing or to work out some of their benefits because they didn't want to lose money in their paycheck. And so that's kind of where we decided to make that comp time decision. But I think just that the model of the case manager and the hiring manager being connected is really critical. So I think that's kind of like the core of our model. And there's a lot of other things that went around that, but we also did financial literacy training, resume building. Our goal was to be an employer that would work with folks for like 2 to 3 years. And then they would be able to either go on one of three pathways, like get promoted up into another higher level position, whether that was production, supervision, or customer service, where they could earn some more money and take on more responsibility, or move out to another job at another employer where they could earn more, learn more. Or some of them decided to start their own businesses. So we were working across like all three of those pathways with our folks. And that was another important part of our model, just because we weren't the size of company and the type of company that could keep like growing people up from like a coordinator to a specialist to a manager to a director. Like it just wasn't, we weren't a large enough organization to do that, but we wanted people to have the opportunity to advance. Right. Because I also don't think that we solve homelessness through employment by putting people into entry-level positions and keeping them there forever. It's not motivating. Just as much as you and I want to experience growth and promotion in our careers, especially over our career lifetime, people experiencing homelessness want that and deserve that opportunity as well. So we have to be thinking not just about like an immediate sort of like triage, get them into a entry-level role. Now they've got a paycheck. Let's figure it out. It's like, no, how do we think a little bit more long-term about what this person's goals are and their interests are and what careers align with those things so that they stay excited and motivated in their job? And be thoughtful about building pathways that allow people to develop over time. So those are all things that we considered really, really heavily in our model.
Yeah. That's, I'm glad that you touched upon like the growth plan as well. And the people who are trying to secure housing or trying to secure benefits, needing to go to appointments and things like that, that's definitely something for people to be aware of, or that, you know, a lot of these people take the bus and maybe they need bus fare. And so they need to get paid more often, like things like that. So I know you had really started to take these things into account and created this incredible model of what you saw employers needed to add into their businesses to not just hire, but I think the big thing that you did is it's not just hire, but to keep them there, right? Job retention rates are really high. I know personally for our Covenant House youth, because they're not set up for success. So what you started to do is create a success model. So it's not that they're just getting jobs and losing them because they show up late because they have to meet with their case manager, or they show up late because the bus schedule doesn't coincide with their work schedule, or they're not getting paid often enough to afford their bus ticket. I mean, we would provide tap cards, but not everybody provides tap cards. So things like that are really important to keep for businesses to keep in mind when they are trying to employ anybody who is trying to get back on their feet, and that takes a while, but they need a voice. And I feel like you really are one of the strongest voices I've ever heard for our population. So is there anything that you want to kind of share about the 100 jobs in 100 days challenge that you think that like really worked well, or that it would continue forward?
Yeah. One of the things that I thought was really cool about the 100 day challenge that was, let me describe a little bit about the 100 day challenge. We were bringing together employers and 5 different case management agencies or homeless service agencies, that were working with people exiting homelessness. We were bringing them together on a weekly basis to coordinate about like hiring fairs, setting up job interviews, doing the actual hiring, and then working on retention. And one of the things that we implemented in that was we created a flex fund pool. So a lot of times at homeless service agencies, the way that they access funds, like emergency funds, like if somebody needs work boots to start their construction job, or their car breaks down or some other transportation obstacle comes into frame, they need to be able to like react quickly to solve that problem for that person, so that they're not being held up from getting to work. And a lot of times at the agencies, those kinds of funds they can't be accessed quickly enough. And so what we did was we had this pool of money that was administered by the case managers. The case managers had full autonomy to make the decisions. And essentially the only parameter that we put on the use of the flex funds was if spending some of this money, and there was a cap per person, but if spending some of this money is going to keep someone getting to work, or if there's something that's going to help someone keep their job, you can spend it. And it was really cool to see how empowered the case managers felt to have access to those resources and to be able to make those decisions. And I think sometimes in larger agencies, it can just get really bureaucratic and not nimble enough to react quickly when there needs to be a quick response. So I loved that part of the model. The end of our challenge was definitely derailed by COVID, so we didn't get to really like have the strong finish we were hoping for. But I think that what I mentioned earlier about like connecting hiring managers with case managers, that proved to be very effective in this like more systems oriented context. And so we were really excited about that. And we were really excited about the flex funds. And I think if there's a way that those two best practices can be applied at scale, I think we could get a lot more people back into the workforce. So, yeah,
I totally agree. I sat in on, as well, you know, but I would, for those listening, I would sit in on these meetings, even though I wasn't a part of them, because I'm not a case manager, just because it was so interesting and really cool to see the way that the case managers were leaning in to hearing the discussions about how they would use those flex funds. I know, like, when I sat in on one of the meetings, they said, one of our case managers said that, you know, one of the youth needed to get to a meeting, but the bus didn't run at the time. We were like, oh, well, you can get them an Uber with the flex funds. And it was just like kind of these really simple answers and solutions to things that typically hold people back and prevent them from securing jobs or keeping them. So I think it was really cool the way that even if you didn't have that strong finish, Britt, it's so cool that you guys did that, and just to see the success of it and the way that everyone came together. I also really hope that continues forward, because it was really special work, and I know you put a lot into it.
And the cool thing too, in that same time frame of 3 months, we did 54 placements, where in the previous 3 months they had done 11.
Wow.
On a systems level. So it was definitely more effective. And I think that feels like a win, just to know that we were able to essentially like 5x the results from the previous period. But
yeah.
And then the one other thing that I think is really important, I just want to share, is that having employers at the table for those conversations is super critical. And often it's the service agencies that are having those conversations, and then they're doing these external meetings with all of their employer partners. But I think if businesses, especially businesses that are really engaged on the issue, can be at the table and have a voice in the conversation and help shape the system, it can be really powerful and effective.
Definitely. Definitely. Oh, I love that. Thank you for sharing that. So now I want to go into the end of this is like, I need to know about you. Like, you give and put out so much. Like, always since the day I met you, you are working tirelessly. It feels like you're driving all around the city. It seems like you work all hours of the day. So one of the things that I like to talk about a lot is that, and that I share, is that when I got into this work, and it was only 5 years ago, I realized how important self-care is, because when you're caring for your community this much and putting so much effort out, you have to be filling up your own cup, right? Otherwise it can't spill over and you have nothing to give anyone. So I would love to know a little bit about like your best practices, how you sort of came to adapt. Like, did you have a burnout moment, and what does that feel like for you, and how do you care for yourself so that you can give back to your community so much?
Yeah, no, this is like my new favorite topic.
Good.
So yes, I mean, being in a startup, you're just, you like leave the office and you feel like you're never done, because there's just always so much that needs to happen in such a short amount of time. So being at Giving Keys was like the most exhilarating, fun, exciting, like I was in my flow state. It was amazing. But then you can only like sustain a like breakneck speed pace for so long before your body starts to kind of like shut down on you. And so for me, that started happening in like 2016, 2017. It was like fully happening in 2017. I think it was like starting to happen in 2016. And I got diagnosed with adrenal fatigue syndrome, which put me on this path of like going to see my homeopath really frequently, like understanding how to better take care of my body. A lot of that had to do with like sleeping more. I would usually operate on like 6 hours of sleep. So I just had to start shifting some of my lifestyle choices. Like, it's not okay every day to like skip breakfast and eat lunch at 3 p.m. and then like have a big dinner. Like that, your body cannot sustain itself on that kind of rhythm. And so my homeopath really helped me understand the connection between my adrenal glands and my hormones. And I had like always had issues with my cycles, and started peeling back the layers of the onion to see that it was, in addition to like the adrenal fatigue, there was also hormonal imbalances that were happening. And so through two different homeopathic doctors, and then also getting a hormone panel with my OB, discovered that I had PCOS, which is polycystic ovarian syndrome, which like 1 in 10 women have it. But it just creates there's a lot of symptoms connected to it. Like low energy, fatigue, insulin resistance. So it would take a whole other podcast, I think, to talk about like all the different kind of diagnoses and what I did to resolve them. But what I'll say is, like it's so basic and so simple. And I feel like we all know these things, but it's hard to maintain like healthy sleep, hydration, healthy eating, exercising when you're in a job that's trying to solve a problem that's too big for one person to solve, or even like dozens or hundreds of agencies to solve. Like it's, you have to be able to pace yourself, or you'll only be able to do the work for so long until you have to, like, your body will take you out of the game. And I'm happy to report that in changing my sleep habits to like staying committed to 8 hours of sleep a night for the most part, and like drinking less wine, like not having that ritual of like, I'm going to have a glass of wine with my husband before we go to bed, like every night. Like cutting out dairy. Part of PCOS is that you have to like reduce inflammation in your body. And the way that part of how you can do that is by cutting out dairy, cutting out gluten, reducing alcohol, and then primarily like cutting sugar. So my goal is to have 25 grams of sugar or less a day, which is basically like 2 servings of fruit. So it was a big adjustment, but like my cycles are totally regular now. I have energy when I wake up in the morning. It's not like this lethargic, like forcing myself to get out of bed. And just generally like my quality of life is so improved. And I think I probably needed to learn that lesson the hard way, because my tendency is just to like keep pushing and keep pushing. But I'm super grateful for the journey to have like gotten more connected with my body and understand what I need to stay healthy. And it's going to look different for everybody. But I feel like I have the energy to keep going now and to keep working on things I care about, but to do it in a way that isn't like sprint and then like pass out and sprint and then pass out. It's like a pace that is manageable day to day.
That's amazing. That's so important that you found that. And, you know, everyone's different. And so, you know, what works for one person might not work for another person. But I also believe that we're capable of pretty hard things. Like we can do really hard things. And giving up those things is quote unquote hard. But for the betterment of your health, of your sleep, of your mind, of your hormones, of, you know, of your whole body and stress levels, that is so worth it. It's just so important to prioritize yourself and your self-care. So I applaud you for doing that. And we actually had this conversation about this. God, when did you come over for dinner? It was like 3 months ago or something, maybe?
Yeah, probably.
And you told me about this and I thought, wow, that sounds great, but I couldn't do that. Like, that sounds great, but I could never do that. And now, before we hopped on this call, I had told you I'm actually doing that same thing now. And oh my God, it makes you feel so good. Yes, it's difficult, quote unquote, but what's more difficult is like waking up really tired and dragging yourself out of bed, waking up hungover, you know, being super stressed and dragging yourself through your day and not having a clear mind, like, I'll take this any day over, totally. You know, that's so much harder. So,
and I think, like, even just the things that we've said quickly in this conversation of, like, reducing alcohol, reducing sugar, cutting out gluten, cutting out dairy, like, having a more anti-inflammatory diet, like, it's daunting. It was definitely daunting for me, and I'm sure it's daunting to others to think about making, like, a total unilateral lifestyle change, including all those things all at once. Yeah. But like, for me, it was easier if I could be like, I'm just going to like not drink for 2 weeks, or I'm going to cut dairy and sugar and gluten for a month and see how I feel.
Yeah.
Like, just test it for a short period of time and see what effect it has on your body. And if it's a positive effect, usually the way that you feel is motivation enough to continue doing it.
Yeah.
Just like you said. So that's like my encouragement to anybody who's listening that's considering making some of those lifestyle changes or has felt burnt out or lethargic or low energy or brain fog. Like, maybe just give it a shot for 2 weeks or a month and see how you feel.
I think that's good advice. I totally agree. Easing into it is definitely less daunting. So
yeah.
Amazing, Britt. Well, two questions to close out. My first question is, obviously you've addressed sort of like a little bit of this self-care, but can you talk us through what's your morning and evening sort of routines or self-care routines? Like, what does that look like for you to get yourself set up for the day and to close yourself out for the day?
I love that. I literally just had a conversation about morning routines yesterday with one of my girlfriends.
Oh, cool. Good. Perfect.
So it's been a little different during quarantine, as I'm sure is the case for most people.
Yep.
But the difference with quarantine is just that I have more time. So some of the rituals that I would do or like habits that I would have just get to happen over like a longer window of time in the morning or in the evening. But generally my morning routine is I get up.
What time?
I get up, it depends, but usually between like 6 and 7.
Okay.
I make myself, I take this like hormonal balancing supplement in the morning. So I like mix the powder with the water and drink that. I take like a couple supplements before I eat, and then I go for a walk. And I try to walk anywhere from 2 to 4 miles every morning. And then I come back, I come back, shower, make myself breakfast. And then I take like the rest of the supplements that I take on a full stomach because I get very nauseous if I don't eat and take them. And then I typically at the start of my like working time, I write down like, what are my top 3 priorities? Like, what are the things that big picture, like I need to be moving towards. They may not be things that I can accomplish today, but I should like find some task that gets me closer to that goal. And then I do like a list of like urgent things that are smaller tasks that are like, these things must happen today, just so I can like see it all and get clear. And then on a really full or busy day, sometimes I'll just take the extra 5 minutes to calendar all of those things, like block it out on my calendar, because one of my struggles is that I think everything can like happen faster than it does. Yeah. And then I like overestimate my ability to get a long list of to-dos done. And then I'm frustrated at the end of the day if I don't finish all of them, but like it wasn't humanly possible with the amount of time that I had. So it's helpful for me to like assign time blocks to things so I can be realistic about what I can actually accomplish in a day.
Love that.
And then at night, I mean, my nighttime routine really is just about like connecting with my husband. We both work a lot and that's like our time together. So we alternate cooking. We're like very much about like 50-50 partnership on the domestic responsibilities, which I am so grateful that he's down for that.
Yep.
So one of us will cook dinner and we'll eat together. And sometimes we'll watch something, sometimes we'll like read together, sometimes we'll sit out on our patio and just have a conversation and like talk about the day. And then before bed, I guess I don't really have a nighttime routine, like now that I'm talking about it. It helps me to like wash my face, brush my teeth. I turn the lights off. I guess this is part of my ritual. At 8 p.m., 9 p.m., we turn off like all of the bright lights and only have the dim lights in our home on.
That's important. Yeah.
So that like your body can start to recognize it's like time to wind down and time to go to sleep. So I guess it's just like something we've been doing for so long that it doesn't feel like a thing, but it's totally a thing.
Yeah, that's definitely part of a ritual. There's studies how important that is to sort of take off the bright lights to start adjusting to your sleep time. No, I love that. I love your day rituals. There's no wrong answer. It's you. So that's perfect. And my last question for you, and I didn't prep you with this, so I'm sorry, I think it's easy. What do you give the most damns about?
Ooh, that's so hard because there's like so many important things to care about. I really care about it's so hard for me. I obviously care about ending homelessness and caring for our homeless neighbors. I also, as a zoom out from that, it's definitely an intersectional issue. I care about racial equity in a very, very deep and real way. And zooming out from that, I think there's tons of intersectionality here as well, like justice reform, like what's happening with mass incarceration in this country. I really care to see that end, and poverty. So a lot of those things are all connected. I would say that whole cluster of things, poverty, racial equity, ending mass incarceration, and homelessness.
That's perfect. You're amazing. Britt, thank you. Not just for being on the podcast, but just for being the person that you are. It's just incredible. You're incredible, and there's just not a lot of people like you in this world. And so I treasure that. I treasure our friendship, and I treasure you as a person. And I just want, there needs to be more yous out there. And I just strive to stand right behind you, and literally I will follow you anywhere, girl. So thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you. This is so fun. Such a fun conversation.
Yeah, I loved it. Many more to come.
All right,
my girl. Well, thank you for being on the podcast. I will tag you in this so people know where to find you. And that way that people can continue to follow your journey and see all the great things that you're doing. And for those listening, as always, you guys, give a damn about your community, give a damn about your neighbor, but most importantly, give a damn about your damn self. Have a wonderful day, you guys. Thank you so much, Britt.
Thank you.